This morning, on our anniversary Sunday, I thought it'd be really appropriate to talk about our mission, why we exist, why we've existed for the last 43 years, and our burden about what God is preparing us for in the coming years. So the mission of the church is stated in many different ways in the New Testament, in many different places. They all come back to what I'm sure is the most well-known of the mission texts, Matthew 28, 19, and 20. We call it the Great Commission or the Great Mission, and it's really the New Testament church's mission text. Matthew 28 says, "Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations." So the mission of the New Testament church is that we are to be a disciple-making people, or we are to be a disciple-making church. And I want you to get used to those terms, because you're going to hear them over and over and over again from me and from our pastors, because this is our mission. This is the mission. This is every church's mission. According to the New Testament, according to Matthew chapter 28, we are to be a disciple-making church. Now, the Bible describes how this is to happen in many different ways, and we're going to go and look at this one in Mark chapter 2, if you want to turn to that text this morning, Mark chapter 2, and I'm going to tell it to you this way. Our mission is to be a disciple-making church. And according to Mark chapter 2, it describes it in this way: by helping those who are broken and wounded and hurting and leading them to Jesus. All right, that's Mark chapter 2. That's what we're going to talk about this morning. By helping those who are broken and wounded and hurting and leading them to Jesus. You might have noticed that we have sort of a funny title. Wreck the Roof is our title for this morning. And in fact, I was just talking with somebody this morning. We probably should decide what kind of people we have in here this morning first, because there are some people that are roofers, and some people are roofers, right? Some people say it roof, and some people say it roof. So first of all, I just want to know how many are with me this morning, and you say, I would say the word roof, like normal people would say. Okay, we got a few. How many of you guys are roofers? Oh, man. How many of you guys would say those crazy English speakers, they don't even know how to speak their own language, right? I had a secretary a while back from Georgia, yeah. And not only did she say roof, but she said it like with two syllables. Roofers. I don't even know how you do that with two syllables, but all right, so I'm in bad company. I can tell already. A lot of roofers here. All right, wreck the roof is what I would say. And in fact, it's not just it's not just up there to be a clever title. I'm really, really passionate and burdened for this concept that we're going to talk about tonight or this morning. And I want to say it in a way not to be clever, but I'd really like to talk about this topic this morning in a way that you'd remember it. All right, so that's the point. I'm hoping that this text is something that will settle into our hearts as a church and as people, and maybe even a little bit of the funny title can help us with that. So Mark chapter 2, if you've turned there, Mark chapter 2 is a narrative. So, you know, we talk about speaking expositorily or exposing the meaning of a text. What that really means is that we expose the meaning of a text in the way that it was intended. All right, so in the Bible, there's different types of literature. There's different ways that it's intended. When we're speaking from or reading or studying from the New Testament epistles, the letters like we've done recently, you know, that's sort of it's a letter to the church, and so it's sort of a line by line talking through that. When we're talking about prophecy from the Old Testament, we have to be careful that we interpret it and work through it in the right way. And then there's these passages like we have this morning that's a narrative. It's a story. So, I mean, we could go through it sort of verse by verse and line by line, but that's not really the intent of the story. The idea is to get the overall understanding of the story. That's what we're going to do. We're going to try to exposit the understanding of the story. And then our outline is going to be an application, some personal applications of it. So that's sort of how we'll work through this passage here this morning. So let's begin reading in verse 1 of Mark chapter 2. And again, he, Jesus, entered into Capernaum after some days, and it was noised that he was in the house. That sounds interesting, right? Jesus is in the house. That's what it said. And straightway, many were gathered together, insomuch that there was no room to receive them. I mean, no, not so much as about the door, and he preached the word unto them. And they came unto him, saying, bringing one sick of the palsy, which was born of four. And when they could not come nigh unto him for the press, they uncovered the roof where he was. Right, they wrecked the roof, is what they did. And when they had broken it up, they let down the bed wherein the sick of the palsy lay. When Jesus saw their faith, he said unto the sick of the palsy, Son, thy sins be forgiven thee. But there were certain of the scribes sitting there and reasoning in their hearts, Why doth this man thus speak blasphemies? Who can forgive sins but God only? And immediately when Jesus perceived in his spirit that they so reasoned within themselves, he said unto them, Why reason ye these things in your hearts? Whether it is easier to say to the sick of the palsy, Thy sins be forgiven thee, or to say, Arise and take up thy bed and walk. But that they may know that the Son of Man hath power on earth to forgive sins, he saith to the sick of the palsy, I say unto thee, Arise and take up thy bed and go thy way into thine house. And immediately he arose, took up the bed, and went forth before them all, insomuch that they were all amazed and glorified God, saying, We never saw it in this fashion. All right, you got this amazing scene. I mean, this amazing picture. Jesus is speaking inside the house. And these four guys show up carrying a man that was paralyzed, been paralyzed for a long time. Four guys carrying, must have been sort of a mat stretcher. And they're bringing him to Jesus. And there are people everywhere. I mean, the crowd is just thronging around this home. Jesus is inside and he's teaching. In fact, the text tells us that there's so many people there that you can't even get to the door. Nonetheless, get into the house in a place close enough where you could see Jesus. I mean, you can't even get close to the door. And so we have these people everywhere and Jesus inside and these four guys bringing this stretcher in order to see Jesus. There's a lot of things that we could talk about from this passage, and I want to just focus in on the first four verses. We'll mention a few things about the rest of it, but the first four verses, and I want to talk about the four guys, all right? I mean, that's what we're going to focus on. The guys carrying the stretcher, and I want you to take a real close look and find out if you are like any of these guys, if you're like them at all. And I want to connect you to four specific things about these guys that I'm hoping that we'll notice here this morning. Here they are. Number one, they cared enough about their friend to do something radical to bring him to Jesus. They cared enough about their friend to do something radical to bring him to Jesus. You should know that there's not a whole lot of sympathy in first century culture for someone who couldn't pull their own weight. From other passages We know that when someone had physical problems, the people assumed it was because of some sin. In fact, over in John chapter 9, the disciples had brought a blind man to Jesus, and their question to Jesus was this. It wasn't, can you help heal this man? But he said this, who sinned, this man or his father? All right, so what the assumption was that if there was some type of a handicap in some way, that there must have been some sin in this person's heritage in order for them to be like this. So they assumed someone must have. And Jesus' response to them was neither. I mean, this man was born blind so that God would be glorified in his life, which, by the way, is a really interesting theology. And Jesus says, this is the reason this was the case, because it was in order that God would be glorified in his life. But that's not how the people of that time saw it. And so what would happen is that someone that was born blind or paralyzed or some other physical or mental handicap, they were really ostracized from the society. They were left out. They were left to beg, somehow, you know, beg enough in order to support themselves. But in this situation, we find four men who cared, who had compassion, and they reached out, and they did something pretty crazy, actually, because they really believed that this man needed to see Jesus. So these men, they did not simply pray about it. They put feet to their prayers. They cared enough about their friend to do something radical to bring him to Jesus. Number two, they believed that Jesus could and would meet these real life needs. I want you to notice that this is a gospel-connected compassion. This is not just nice people. It's not just a nice people doing nice things. There's a lot of nice people in this world, a lot of nice people doing a lot of nice things, but these people brought him to Jesus. They brought him to Jesus. You just can't help but be impressed as you read this passage with this thought. There is no other reason that they would have gone to this extent unless they believed with all of their heart that Jesus was the one, and in fact, Jesus was the only one who could help him. So this must be your conviction. Listen closely. This must be your conviction. Jesus is the only one who can meet the real life needs of the people that you know. And more than likely, they're not going to get to him on their own. They need you to bring them. They're going to need help. They need you to bring them. Number three, they did not permit difficult circumstances to discourage them, and they did not allow obstacles to detour them. I'm getting passionate about this. Man, I love this so much. This idea of this kind of ministry just gets my blood pumping about ministry. But verse 4 says, when they saw the size of the crowd and that the door was blocked, these men said, well, I'm sorry, Charlie, there's just nothing to do about it, right? I mean, it's not going to happen today. There's a big crowd. There's no way we're going to get through this crowd. I guess you just got to go back in the same way that you came here. It's too many people. It's too hard. No, that's not what they did. They went up on the roof. And you talk about some serious persistence and at great risk. We don't have any indication that these people are homeowners, right? This is somebody else's roof. Like many Palestinian houses, this home probably had an outside stairway that's leading up to a flat roof. Around here, we can sort of picture this. An outside stairway up to a flat roof would have been very typical in this part of the world at this time. And up they went, that outside stairway, mat stretcher in tow. I mean, four of them, right, carrying this guy on this stretcher up to the top of the roof. And they got up there and they just started digging. I mean, they just started digging. The roof probably would have been a composite of grass and clay and clay tiles and laths. It wasn't a modern roof, right? It wasn't a concrete roof. It wasn't some type of a metal-formed roof. But it also wasn't just some simple branches. I don't think this was a picture of they just sort of parted some branches aside. This was a roof that was meant to walk on, and that's what they did. It was meant to keep the rain out. I mean, these outside steps were sort of like patios up on top of the roof. And so this was a serious composite of a roof, a permanent roof. And guess what? Not only did they go up on the roof, they did something else. Somebody help me out. What did they do? They wrecked the roof, right? They wrecked the roof. They dug a hole, and I'm not talking about a little hole. This was a hole big enough to lower a stretcher through, and they probably found some fishing rope or something lying around and let this guy down. I mean, can you imagine this scene? I mean, these four guys show up carrying the guy in the stretcher, and they're looking out over this big crowd. There's no way they're getting in the door. I wish I could have heard this conversation. And who was the first one who said, you know what? What if we went up on the roof? And I can listen to his friends going, are you crazy? I mean, that's not your house, is it? That's not my house. No, we can't go up on the roof. I mean, what is everybody going to think? But this one guy, evidently there's one guy persistent enough, and I'm telling you, man, I want to be that guy. I am telling you, that's the guy I want to be. Didn't matter what anybody else said. He was like, my buddy has got to get into that place, and I don't know how this is going to take, but how this is going to happen, but we're going to get him in there. So they go up on the roof. And then what about the people inside? And all of a sudden, you know, Jesus is talking, he's sitting down like he normally would, teaching, and all of a sudden you look up and like the roof is crumbled a little bit, there's some debris coming down, and all of a sudden this head pops down, right? Can you imagine this scene? And you look up and you're like, what are you guys doing? And they just keep going, they just keep tearing stuff up until finally they lower the stretcher down into the room in order for him to see Jesus. I want to give you this fourth thought. That is that they understood the great impact of the combined efforts of a group of people with a common purpose. Did you know that this is one of the great benefits of the church? It's one of the reasons God designed the church. Every believer has been called individually to be active in bringing needy people to Jesus. But let me tell you this, there is a significant difference between the impact of one person on their own and the combined impact of a group of believers who are all focused on accomplishing the same thing. I mean, it's exponential, the difference. I love the church. We're going to come back really soon to start talking about this incredible organization, this organism that God developed of the church. But this is one of the awesome things about the church, because we can do so much more together than we could ever accomplish on our own. It's really hard for one guy to get, you know, a guy in a stretcher up on the roof and lower down, but four of them together, all with this passion to figure out how to get this done in order to move this guy into the presence of Jesus, then we can get it done. It's amazing what we can do when we all strategize together. So they understood this impact. Let me give you a couple of applications before I'm done here. Number one, we'll always have greater impact together than you'll have on your own. This is powerful stuff. This is sort of a life-changing realization when we get to it that I want to combine with other people. I want to be part of God's church and the work that God is doing in our world. Listen, I believe with all my heart that God sees what is going on here in this place. God sees what's going on here at Harvest. And this morning, I wonder if he's gazing across this room, and his question this morning is, where are four men? I wonder if there are four ladies in that congregation who will care enough about the people around them that they'll combine together to do something radical, to start bringing people to Jesus, who will encourage each other and make a difference for Christ on this island. Verse 12, all the way down, tells us the result. Well, the people watch and say, we've never seen anything like this before. That just makes me laugh. I bet they hadn't. You know, it seems to me that there are two kinds of people in this scene. There's a whole large mass of spectators, right? Whole bunch of people watching the action, watching what's going on. And then there are a few, just a quartet in this situation, that are the players. They're the doers. Tim Keller said, the church is often like a football stadium where 22 people need rest and thousands of people need exercise. I think the church sometimes is like that. Lots of people just are very content to be spectators. They probably walked right past this guy on the way to see Jesus. I mean, they had to go. They didn't have time for this distraction on their way. And I sort of picture this guy kind of calling out to them, hey, listen, I want to go too. I can't get there on their own, but I have some needs. Would somebody help me? And then they're all cramming into the place, and they're basking in the preaching of Jesus, and they're worshiping him together, and the band is playing, right? And they're all worshiping Jesus. And all the while, they've had their backs turned to the needs of this paralyzed man, so much so that he can't even break through the crowd. Four guys with him can't break through the crowd to get through the throng of people worshiping Jesus in order to bring the needs of this one to him. Boy, I'm burdened that we would never, never, never be that kind of a church. Enjoying our worship and our fellowship so much that we're totally oblivious to the crying needs of people all around us. Would you be burdened for that with me? But then we have these four men, these four guys who are going to do something, the doers, the players. And they're able to participate with God in the life-fulfilling experience of seeing someone meet Jesus Christ and having their needs met and their sins forgiven and their life changed. And there is nothing more rewarding in life than that. There is no greater high than that. So we'll always have greater impact together than we'll have on our own. We must not be discouraged by the obstacles. Of course there's going to be obstacles. That's what keeps everybody else from getting things done. Of course there's going to be obstacles, but some people just have to say, forget about the obstacles. I'm going to climb up on the roof and I'm going to start digging. People of vision who would dare to dream about what God wants to do. Number three, we must start asking two questions about our island. Please hear me on this. We must start asking two questions about our island. What are the needs and how could we strategize to meet them? This is the definition of vision in my definition book. The ability to see needs and then determine what we can do to meet them. It's really from the men of Issachar in the books of Chronicles who understood the times and knew what they should do. They were people of vision. They could see the needs and knew what should be done. I'm praying that God would give us a whole team of visionaries here at Harvest, that we'd be able to see the needs around us. We wouldn't turn our backs to, we wouldn't spend our time worshiping Jesus with our backs to the needs of the people around us. We would see the needs and then figure out, strategize, plan, wreck the roof in order to figure out what to do to help meet the needs and help bring them to Jesus. Would you dream with me about a whole vision of ministry? Dream with me about caring for and meeting the needs of this island, whatever the cost in roof tiles, whatever it takes. One of my mentors, actually you know them, Doug McLaughlin, I heard this, I was a young guy, and I heard him say one time, in fact he said it to me, if you care for hurting people, God will send hurting people to you, and I believed that. I've always told him I was young enough and foolish enough to believe that. If you care for people, God will send hurting people to you, and I'm telling you, it is true. Because God's looking for places where he can send hurting people, and he knows that they'll be cared for. I'm so thankful this morning. I'm overwhelmed by God's goodness in the history of Harvest Baptist Church. 43 years, so many of you have been so faithful through this time, and God's brought people after people to this place in an amazing, amazing ministry. We're standing today in the footsteps of visionaries of faith. It's amazing what God has done. But I believe that God has some more to do here. And I don't know exactly what it's going to look like. I really don't. But I'm asking if you would pray with me about this. As God keeps bringing people here to Harvest and God keeps bringing people in the family, I do know this. God did not bring us together so we could sit in this campus and bask in our privilege of worshiping Jesus. I know that. Certainly not while our backs are turned to the needs, both spiritual and physical, all around us. Verse 5 says that when Jesus saw their faith, here's my observation, here's my experience. God always honors faith, and he honors the people who have faith and live it and show it. I know I'm a dreamer, but I look around here at the resources that God has put in place over 43 years here at Harvest Ministries, and it's incredible. You guys, we stand on such a privileged place. And I look about at all these resources that God has given us of people and campus and buildings and opportunities in front of us. And listen, there are people on this island and there are people in your world just like this man. Not paralyzed. I'm telling you, there are people in your world right now that you and I probably walked by this week on our way to church. They're broken in some way. Young people. And I'm telling you, they're just walk down the street. There are young people everywhere, all around this island, and they are searching, searching, searching. Can you feel that? Do you walk by them and say, man, these guys are just looking for something to do, someplace to go, something to give themselves to? Got college students in this region, not very far from us, lots of college students. And they're trying to figure out, for a lot of them, how do I get out of this place that I'm at right now? Whatever their situation is, I just want to get out. Maybe I go to school so I could get out. But I'm telling you, the answer for them is not to get out, right? Well, who's going to tell them what the answer is? Who's going to get out where they are and find them in their questions and the things that they're asking, and they're trying to find answers to life at this critical stage? Who is going to get out there and tell them, I want to point you to Jesus because he's got answers? Who's going to do that? And young couples and military and older couples who are battling for their marriages and whatever the group is, you put the You put the group together, single mom, whatever it is. People fighting addictions across this area, people's lives who've been wrecked by drugs and alcohol, and people who've made a lot of bad choices, and then just people who've been going about life and they haven't made a lot of bad choices, but they still feel so hopeless and helpless. Who's going to meet them? Who's going to see them along the way? Who's going to combine with the three or four other people and find a mat and pick them up and figure out how to bring them to Jesus? We have to see them. We have to open our eyes. We have to be willing to do something, probably something creative. And we might have to wreck the roof. We might have to build a bridge. But do what God wants us to do and never settle for sitting in neutral with our backs to the needs of the world all around us. Will you be part of the roof-wrecking crew that will dream and ask God specifically to help you answer this vision question? What are the needs and how can we strategize to meet them? I think God's asking for volunteers. Will you lift up your hand? Will you lift up your hand and join that group? I don't know whether it's going to be small or large, that are part of the Harvest family and who will say, I want to get involved in that life-changing ministry of introducing hurting people to Jesus. Will you lift your hand to him this morning?